From KCRW, this is DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. When is a Japanese restaurant not a Japanese restaurant?
Should we, revere what is essentially an act of cultural copy and paste, or should we just appreciate it for the corny Los Angeles kitsch that it brings?
We hike up to Yamashiro, the famed Hollywood hilltop restaurant. It's part of our ongoing look at identity and design. First up, though, Prince Harry and Meghan, Duchess of Sussex, looked stunning. But how about their Jaguar? This past Saturday's royal wedding delivered a number of surprises and lots of eye candy, and that included the car the newly married couple drove off in. This was a 1968 Jaguar E-Type, but it glided away without making any sound at all. And that's because it's electric. It was an E-Type Concept Zero, that is, a vintage Jaguar restored and converted to E-Power. So could this be the answer for those who love yesterday's automobile styling but want to meet today's energy concerns? Jeff Wardle is Executive Director of Graduate Transportation Systems and Design at Art Center College of Design.
Now, Jaguar has always been well-known and famous for really good-looking, almost exotic, powerful performance cars, whether they're sedans or whether they're sports cars. And I think that the car, the Jaguar, that people know best all over the world is the E-Type Jaguar. And to make that into an electric conversion, I think says a lot about what Jaguar are trying to convey to their public.
And nicely translates from an E-Type to an E-Type, as in E now standing for electric.
Yes.
So the fact that a member of the royal family chose explicitly to drive in this car, what did that signal? Because the royal family owns many a fabulous car, and many of them are gas-guzzling.
Indeed. That said, I think that there are branches of the royal family that have been very concerned about their ecological footprint and how the world is changing and what we need to do to put it right.
So how much does this kind of conversion cost? I'm assuming it doesn't come cheap. And what's involved technically?
Well, it depends what you're trying to convert. So if you've got an old clunker, you could probably convert it into an electric battery electric vehicle for, between $5,000 and $15,000. But it probably wouldn't go very far before it started to spark. I would say the expense of these conversions rises exponentially according to the amount of performance and power you want to get out of it, and of course the range, how far you want it to go. So I imagine if I had my own vintage E-Type Jag and I wanted it to convert it into an electric vehicle in the same way that Jaguar have just shown, I should think it would be easily a six-figure number at the high end of six figures.
Right. Perhaps. I've seen 400,000 around.
Exactly. Jaguar probably spent a lot more than that. It's not a cheap conversion, that's for sure. Now, if Jaguar were to go forward and put a car like this into series production, whether it's vintage or a brand new car, then of course they would be looking to bring the cost down much more to make it affordable for you and I.
But you've mentioned that you can convert a clunker to electric. But I guess this would be my question, which is, can this converting to electrification be done to any classic car? Could you turn a Ford Thunderbird or a Pontiac Firebird? Could you make them into an e-car? Could all those old American muscle cars be electrified?
Yes, I think so, because essentially what you're doing is you're chucking out the old gasoline engine and gearbox and drive shafts and replacing it with batteries, an electric motor, which power to weight is usually much more compact than a gasoline internal combustion engine, and that's it. So it's actually quite straightforward. The clever part is more in the power management, the electrical management of the system. That's where a lot of the cost comes. So yes, in theory, you can convert pretty much anything. I've seen old Volvo Amazons, I've seen Honda Civics, I've seen Volkswagen Beetles. As I say, whether you'd actually want to ride in one for very far, that's another matter.
Got it. One of the joys, I suppose, of driving a muscle car and a beautiful old sports car is that there's a noise attached, you know, that may not be so pleasant for the onlookers, for the people the car is racing past, but for the driver, the sound of the power is part of the experience. And now what we're witnessing is these cars going completely silent. Is a sports car still a sports car when there's no noise?
That is a very, very good question, and I've been asking myself that quite a bit lately. So I think that we may have to rethink what sports car means in the absence of noise if we go towards a future, which may well happen, where pretty well every car we drive and are asked to drive is all electric. Quite a lot of sports cars on the market now, mass-produced sports cars, actually introduce artificial noise into the cabin or to the exhaust system to make them sound sportier. And so what the driver hears inside the car sounds a lot raughtier than actually it sounds outside the car, which in many ways is the more sociable thing to do anyway.
So pursuing this line of inquiry, if classic sports cars are going electric, could they also go autonomous?
That I find a little bit more difficult to answer. I can imagine driving a very, very rewarding sports car that doesn't make much noise because it's electric. Why I would want to drive a sports car without driving it, if you see what I mean, that is a little more difficult for me to get my head around. The whole point of sports cars is for the driving experience. And although I've had students in my program try to define what the future of sports cars or enthusiast cars will be in a ubiquitous autonomous future, it's kind of difficult to get my head around, I must admit.
That was Jeff Wardle at Art Centre College of Design. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Now from the UK to Venice, Italy. There, the Venice Architecture Biennale kicks off this weekend. And if you're thinking, isn't that the city full of canals where people get around by gondola? Well, yes, you're absolutely right.
You don't think about it when you're planning an exhibition, and then you sort of get into the logistics of it. And you never knew that your catalogs were going to come on a boat and be unloaded in a canal and then sort of put on a cart and hand carted to the door of the pavilion. And so it's a little bit of the 21st century meets the 19th century.
This is Mimi Zeiger. She's an LA-based architecture critic and writer, and she's the co-curator of the Biennale's US Pavilion, which joins pavilions from more than 60 other countries in the gardens of the Arsenale. That's the complex of former shipyards where the Venice Biennial takes place. This is one of the foremost global get-togethers for anyone interested in current and future thinking about architecture. The theme for the US Pavilion is Dimensions of Citizenship. Back to Mimi Zeiger.
We have been really quite interested in going beyond the idea of the nation or sovereignty as a representation of citizenship. And by that, I mean, we want to go beyond the proverbial wall. That when we talk about citizenship, we are talking about things from the scale of the body all the way to the scale of the cosmos, with stops along the way for the city, for the nation, for the region, for the globe. We begin with the scale of the citizen, and that is by artists Amanda Williams, Andres Hernandez, and Shawnee Crowe, which centers around this question of what they're calling Black women's space matters. And they have created a steel structure, which is then hand woven with braided cord. Shawnee Crowe is an artist who works in hair. She's done Solange's hair sculptures. So this piece is very metaphorical, very poetic, very tactile, but also new vocabulary for architecture. It is a form, but it may not be a form that you've ever seen before.
And then you have a team in terms of designers from our own backyard. Our own backyard That's is right. represented by Estudio Tel de Cruz and Fona Forman. Tell us about what they're doing and who they are.
For Angelinos, people are probably aware of the border prototypes. Teddy and Fauna are really interested in understanding what happens when we remove the wall. And they've been tracking actually the watersheds that are in the area along the border wall. And their proposal is called MEXIS, the combination of Mexico and the U.S. It is defined by 7 watersheds. And they are looking specifically at the Tijuana River watershed, but they're going to be showing a giant map, something that Teddy likes to call the monster. What they're hoping that it represents is that this is a trans-border commons where we can have free exchange or free flow of ecologies and rivers or flow of people, and it becomes more of a space rather than a single line.
So in terms of a biennial that is called an architecture biennial, we're talking here not strictly buildings.
Absolutely. I think we are very much interested in how do we use the tools of architecture, this ability that we have to make visible certain things like a giant mapping system, which is what Teddy and Fauna are showing, but also Diller Scofidio Renfro at the scale of the globe. Have taken 2 sets of satellite images. One is of the globe during the day, and the other is the globe at night. And they are looking at areas that have light and no people, and then places that have people but no light. And oftentimes, these two conditions are right next to each other. So in doing this, they're exploring the built environment and resources. Who gets what and who is counted? So you basically stand in this room with this data sort of washing over the wall and take it all in. And it's quite immersive.
But to some extent, the U.S. Pavilion functions as, I guess, a sort of cultural statement on behalf of the U.S., and it takes its place alongside pavilions from many other countries. What other messages are you seeing coming out in these pavilions?
The Brazil pavilion, for instance, is called Walls of Air, and it is looking at a whole series of mapping projects that are about flows of refugees, flows of resources, flows of real estate, capital, as well as a series of projects. And it's quite beautiful. But again, they are interested in sort of the social political aspects of architecture. And the same is true of the German pavilion, which is called Unbuilding Walls, which is created on the anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And then, say, like the British pavilion is called Island, and it is completely eschewing the interior of the pavilion and have built a platform on the roof of the pavilion, and they are staging a series of events up there throughout the run of the Biennale.
So it sounds as if they're taking a repudiation of Brexit position.
It seems to be, yes. I think they are also staging the Tempest up there at some point.
That's Mimi Zeiger. She's an architecture critic and journalist based in LA, and she's co-curator of the US Pavilion for the 2018 Venice Architecture Biennale that opens later this week. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, is cultural appropriation okay if it happened a century ago? We visit the supposedly Japanese restaurant Yamashiro in the age of identity politics. Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Now, if you live in LA, you've very likely heard of Yamashiro, the faux Japanese temple built into the chaparral-covered Hollywood Hills. But this location, to many of us an innocent and charming example of LA's love of stage-set architecture, did not play so well with Los Angeles Times reporter Frank Xiong.
A temple is in the Japanese context, a place where people think about their relatives and have these sort of quiet, reflective moments, you know. And so when we sort of in America take these parts of these cultures, you know, we should also think about, you know, what their contexts were.
Xiong recently published a fascinating meditation on the authenticity of Yamashiro, which is on the National Register of Historic Places. He asked whether it should be considered within the framework of cultural appropriation, and he called it, quote, an inauthentic fantasy of Japanese culture that has generated profits exclusively for non-Japanese people. As part of our series on identity and design, we're going to consider this and ask, how should we evaluate objects and buildings that mean different things to different viewers? First up, here's a bit of background on Yamashiro.
Well, that was built in 1914, and as it turns out, two Jewish brothers, the Bernheimers, built that. And it wasn't a restaurant. It was where they lived. That was their home.
Edmund Rodman is a historian who's tracked the evolution of Yamashiro.
There were two bachelor German-American brothers with a huge interest in Asian art. And at the time, there wasn't a whole lot up there. This was before the Chinese theater. I mean, one of the things that was on that hill was the property that continues that today is the Magic Castle, I think, was already there. As the structure went up, they hired Chinese laborers to come in and help them, you know, craftsmen and laborers camped out on this hillside to build this thing. And I can only imagine what the buzz was in the surrounding area as this project went up.
The name Yamashiro translates as Mountain Palace, and it's a replica of a palace located in the Yamashiro Province Mountains near Kyoto, Japan. It morphed from being a private home to a secret clubhouse for Hollywood's elite during the 1920s, but later anti-Japanese sentiments spread in the lead-up to World War II. Post-Pearl Harbor, Yamashiro was rumored to be a signal tower for the Japanese. Vandals stripped it of its landscaping and decorative elements, and the estate became a boys' military school. Then, in 1963, it became a restaurant. So Frank Xiong, a reporter at the LA Times, decided to take his girlfriend there for a birthday dinner.
But, you know, when we got there, it seems I was inaccurate in labeling this a Japanese restaurant. And we were both kind of a little bit disappointed with the experience, although the view was fantastic.
So you went there looking for an authentic Japanese meal. You got a different kind of meal within a building that I guess also had some of the same contradictions that you found in the food.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, the building is an impressive looking building, and it looks like a some sort of really Japanese structure. And it incorporates like a lot of ancient sort of Japanese artifacts and things that were taken from Japan, but also things that seemed Chinese as well. But then I interviewed a Japanese architectural expert on this, and basically she came to the conclusion that this wasn't remotely Japanese.
And then you also referred in your piece to a chop suey script. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by that?
That's just a particular type of font that American people have used to sort of signify or theme sort of Asian things for a while.
So you found that Yamashiro, to your surprise, was a kind of mashup of Asian theming. Would that lead you to say that it shouldn't be on the National Register or that the application somehow misrepresented it?
I don't think I would be the only one to say that the National Register of Historic Places is an incomplete sample of American history. I guess that was one of the questions I wanted to raise. You know, are there fissures in what we sort of revere as history? Should we, you know, revere what is essentially an act of cultural copy and paste, or should we just appreciate it for the corny Los Angeles kitsch that it brings?
You're listening to Frank Xiong. In his essay in the Los Angeles Times, Xiong called out Yamashiro for being protected by a listing on the National Register of Historic Places, while longtime businesses in Little Tokyo face displacement. We asked him if the National Register should focus on ethnic communities instead of just ersatz ethnic buildings.
Yeah, I think there's tons of examples of ethnic communities in the United States who have these histories that are now really important to, you know, people like me who are the descendants of that culture. You know, the 100-year-old French hospital, and it was Chinatown's only hospital. I wrote about that last year. And it closed recently, and it didn't have any sort of protections upon it. So it has this fascinating history of transitioning from French to Chinese to Pan-Asian as Chinatown and that surrounding area has changed, you know. But you don't find the French hospital on the National Register of Historic Places, you know. To me, something like, you know, in Chinatown, we have one of the restaurants where, you know, the first dim sum in the United States was served, you know. I think that if we, you know, considered Asian American or Chinese American food history a part of our history, then that's something worth preserving too.
That was Frank Xiong, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Now, after talking with Frank, I went up to Yamashiro for drinks and a conversation with Eve Epstein. She's VP of content at the home decor site Hunker, and she has a very personal interest in hybrids like Yamashiro.
Because of the sort of hybrid nature of my own identity and feelings that I've wrestled with of sort of inauthenticity in my life, which is to say I'm half Japanese. My mother was Japanese born, and my father is a Caucasian guy from New York, Jewish guy. For most of my life, particularly with respect to my Japanese heritage, I really wrestled with the feeling, especially when I was in Japan, of not being Japanese enough. So the first thing for me that springs to mind when I look at or think about or consider a place like Yamashiro is I see some aspect of myself reflected in it because I identify to a certain degree with that sense of not being an authentically Japanese artifact. A space is an expression of who you are, of your identity. Oftentimes we use that to mean something a lot lighter, which is to say like, hey, you know, you should really, like, if you're kind of a boho person, you should put boho stuff in your house. But I think at a deeper level, it speaks to me about how it is that the places we inhabit or design or create do express our feelings about our own culture or somebody else's. And, you know, I think questions about Asian American identity have been very much at the fore of a bunch of different conversations in the news and in entertainment and part of a larger conversation about diversity in multiple industries. And I think, you know, one of the things I think that's really hard about coming out on one side of this or another is that it's incredibly complicated. But I'm, in theory, at least loath to pass judgment on this place.
But I am eager to know, what is your judgment?
Well, my feeling about it was, you know, it didn't remind me of being in Japan. But I think that, I don't think there's anybody who comes to Yamashiro and doesn't come away having a pretty good feeling about, you know, Japanese architecture and culture. Like, I think they come here to appreciate it. You know, I do think, you know, to me that there's also an interesting question or an interesting distinction that happens for an example of what I'm thinking about is the girl in Utah who wore the cheongsam to her prom and who's not Asian American.
Which caused outrage. She posted an image of herself. She's a white girl from Utah. She's wearing the Chinese cheongsam, which is the high-necked dress, or it's also called the kipao. And people got very upset. A lot of, I guess, Asian Americans said, how dare you wear this dress that is of our culture? What do you know about our culture? But the Chinese, mainland Chinese, had a different response.
Well, precisely. And I think that Asian American folks are minorities and they represent a culture in a very different way from Chinese people in China who are not minorities and who I think are in a much different position. They have the liberty, I think, to see it as just a compliment, as a tribute to their great culture and to their beautiful clothing design. I think for folks who live in this country as minorities, the urge and the need to defend that and to define it better is completely understandable. It's sort of like the conversation about, like, when does a building go from being, you know, an authentic piece of architecture to sort of a theme park, right? It's sort of, at what point is it just wearing a different kind of dress versus a costume? And the truth is that America is always interpreting somebody else's thing. As a nation that's made up from its very beginning of people from all different places, we were bound to be getting stuff wrong from the start. But and I think you have to have some sense of humor about it as well. Although, again, I really understand when people aren't in a place to laugh about those things.
And also the context in Los Angeles is very particular because Yamashiro is just one of many cheerful fakes in LA's architectural landscape. We could drive 500 yards and find a French chateau or an Italian villa or a half-timbered cottage, which is, I think, what made Frank Xiong's meditation on Yamashiro so interesting to me, because should we be applying the same logic that he's applied to the Mayan Theater, to the Getty Villa, to Gelaguetza, which is a Korean building that's now a Mexican restaurant, but it was based on an actual Korean building, and one gets sort of caught up in knots with these derivations.
There's an element of camp, I think. I don't know how many people come here and actually think they're experiencing something authentic. I think plenty of people understand that what they're experiencing is a Hollywood set that's really a relic less of Japanese culture than of Hollywood culture 100 years ago and throughout those years in between.
That was Eve Epstein. She's VP of content for the home interiors website, Hunker.
Yamashiro was built precisely when Hollywood was taking shape as a motion picture industry and beginning to concentrate in and around the Hollywood area.
This is Eric Avila. He's a professor of history at UCLA.
So one way to think about Yamashiro is to think of it as kind of an extension of the movie set, kind of a stage for people to act out their fantasies of being like a star.
But I think you've said that there was sort of something darker going on at the same time.
I think so. I think when Yamashiro was built as this kind of ersatz or faux imitation of a Japanese temple or palace, it was precisely the moment when Japanese Americans and Japanese immigrants were facing a wave of hostility that surfaced through a variety of laws to restrict Japanese immigration specifically, and also to prohibit land ownership among Japanese people in California.
Do you think this kind of background should be factored in when an organization like the National Register for Historic Landmarks is considering what buildings to list?
Yes, I do. I mean, if you're going to acknowledge the history of a building, if you're going to celebrate the history of a building, I think you have to be fully aware of what that history was and what that history entailed. By no means is Yamashiro the exception. Think about the mission and how the mission inspired this creation of an exotic, kind of otherworldly landscape in Southern California that also reflects that same principle of, you know, borrowing is one term we could use. Other people might use the term theft. Again, it depends on your perspective. It depends on your politics. Depends upon a clear and full understanding of the history and the historical moment in which they were built.
That was Eric Avila. He's professor of history at UCLA. And that's it for today's DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Ava Shayatsi is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. You can follow us at Facebook and Instagram at KCRWDNA. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week.